All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Welcome once again to another episode of All the Rage. I'm very fortunate this week to say I have a guest. Guest, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, my name's Darren Brearley, and I'm a writer and a little bit mad, but that's okay. You'll get to love me later.
Indeed, you will. Now, these shows of mine and Dave's normally have a wonderful structure to them. You know, we normally do things in a particular kind of type of, you know, we talk about pretty much everything that's on the table. Me and my pal Darren, however, we don't do structured conversations in quite the same way, do we? So we're
not at all. Structure. I've heard of it. I'm not quite sure what it means.
No, me neither, mate. We're gonna roll with this. We do have a couple of subjects I want to talk about this week.
Cool.
And so I want to talk about culture. Again, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know that culture is something that comes up all of the time. Look, I don't have the smartest, best takes on it in the world. I can point you towards the people I think do, but I can talk about its importance in everyday life. And I think this is something that's worth discussing now, where I'm sure this is the same in other parts of the world. But with the terrible COVID-19 pandemic that's still carrying on, and as we always say every week, love and solidarity to anyone out there. I know that doesn't give you anything except perhaps a bit of moral support. But anyway, we're seeing the arts sector getting hammered. And we're gonna come across that at some point. So we got a series of basic setup questions, haven't we? The way I wrote these questions out, I don't have to do them the same way, but I was going to say, like, we're going to talk about culture in our own personal lives, but if you want to talk about it on a wider context or arts funding or shit like that, where do you want
sure,
to go?
No, I will, but culture really does, it covers so many different aspects of life, and it's not just drawing and painting and singing and music, and culture is even such a diverse word in itself, of the culture of a community, the culture of a country, the culture of a people. Some people that I know who are diehard artists in the sense of writing would say, how dare I say that culture even involves, you know, sport. But even that itself is its own community, is its own culture, it has its own following. So why not? You know, it brings people together to shout, to scream, to let loose, to share an ideology, to share a story.
To have a united event.
Yeah, basically. I want to touch on sport, but then I actually want to talk about my culture.
Okay.
In that sense of, so when I was, you know, so you can probably tell by the accent, that's the other thing I haven't told anybody who was listening, I'm actually from Melbourne, Australia, now living in London, but don't tell the CIA, oh, hang on, wrong country, and MI5.
I don't go into kind of teasing my foreign friends with tropes, but I do have to ask, do you work in a bar?
Do I work in a bar? I have worked in a bar, I've worked in many bars.
Of course you fucking have. Sorry, go on, mate.
Oh boy, I can make you a cocktail. I just can't spin a bottle. I'm sorry, but I can make you drink. I can pull a beer. My father said to me, "Son, pull a beer, and you can work anywhere in the world." And he wasn't half wrong.
No, it's a very good point. Until this happened, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, exactly.
But no, I mean, 99% of the time, that's a good, you know. I have a friend who travelled the world, and he's an accountant. He's a trained accountant. And that was another one of those jobs. It's like, yeah, wherever he goes, he got a job. It's like, oh, it works.
As long as you can pull a beer, don't, you know, who cares? Smile, take the money, pull a beer, next, thanks. That's all that matters.
Sweet.
My mother, it's at the age of, I think I would have been 11, I'm guessing. And she took me to the Australian rules football. And if anybody has seen Australian rules football, it's like kind of like a moving boxing match. All at the same time, it's pretty tough. You know, they may wear short shorts and have all those legs, but boy, you know, there's punch-ups and fights, and it's kind of like a bar brawl with a bit of football kicking in between. And so my mother, who was in her 50s, mild-mannered, you know, sort of Clark Kent, take me to the football. We sat up in the gods. And this woman who was sitting next to me was screaming and expletives and shouting. And I'm thinking, who are you? So yeah, I think that was the time she went away to get away from my father to shout. Probably in her head, she was probably shouting at him, but it was a good opening to sport. So yeah, but look, it brings people together. You know, they can all shout together.
Useless bastard! You can't kick the ball. You can't clean up the kitchen either. Where did that come from?
There was a few F bombs in between all that from my mum. My mum, you know, nurse. You know, kind. I'm not saying people who swear aren't kind, but you know, it's just, it was a complete contrast with this woman who I knew as my mother. All of a sudden, was someone's spilt water on her, or they fed her after midnight, or she got caught in the full moon. I really don't know what it was, but boy, yeah. So yeah, there you go.
All I'll say to that is never trust anyone who doesn't swear. Maybe.
Oh, that made you trust me implicitly. Oh,
I entrust you with my life, mate.
So, yeah, what was the question?
I fucking cannot remember.
I think it was all about culture.
Oh, yeah, so we were talking about culture. We're talking about it as a uniting of, like you said, so sport. I mean, just I'll come back on that before you go on. So, interestingly, yeah. I'm not a big fan of sport. I have no real interest in it outside. I mean, I follow anti-fascist football teams whenever I can, but that's really just for the anti-fascism rather than the football. But I do appreciate it as an event like that. I mean, I've been in, I love live music when it's happening. So I go to gigs and I mosh like a lunatic and I get involved in that kind of creative chaos. And I see that on the terraces of a football game, etc., or something like that. What I'm interested in, though, actually, for just as a response to some of your friends you said who don't think sport is culture. Well, okay, so what is it then?
It's sport.
Just an entity that doesn't exist outside of any other form of culture.
Yeah, basically, it's kind of like how to put it on a grander scale. So it would be something similar to it has a stigma between of us and them. It's those who, you know, I've often said if I was as dedicated and I think as talented, I'm sort of blowing my own trumpet here, but if as a writer, but if I think I was as good as a writer as I was a footballer, I would probably be a multimillionaire by now. Only because it's, you know, but then you get into economics and the amount of people who, you know, who follow the sport and how cheap it is to, well, certainly cheap, but it's just... Yeah, it's there's a lot of money in sport because there's a lot of people who follow it, and then there's a lot of franchising behind it, and all that sort of, it's a whole different financial structure.
Yeah. And the money in a lot of sport, especially in like football in Britain, is
football anywhere, football of any guise of the word football, and so we would in Australia we would call English football soccer. And so it's, I think some people just fainted now because I said the S word.
Believe me, I've said substantially more controversial things on this show. Although this will be the one that probably gets us death threats. Go on.
Probably get the hit now. But what I'm saying is that any particular sport like that will have a lot of following and money behind it, because I think it's something that it's, look, I don't understand the rules. I don't understand. You kick a ball, you kick it to the next person, and then you get it through the goal. That's about as much as I understand it.
Yeah,
but what I do understand that it brings people together, and I can even go to a party, and we can all sit round and be drinking beer and throwing food at the television and screaming and whatnot. But the point is, I can still sit there and scream and shout and throw food. I have no idea why I'm doing it, but it's, you know, I'm sitting with a bunch of friends and we're just together, and so that's kind of what it's. I think that's really, there is a culture there. But my friends who would think, oh, how could I say such a thing? It's the money. They are treated like demigods, the players. They are. And so I haven't seen the National or Royal Ballet or the London Symphony Orchestra being put up in hotels to play in events on a weekly basis, so they're isolated, so they're not interacting with any other orchestras. Same with ballet, same with the theatres are closed. I mean, the football stadiums are closed. So, you know, people could have that argument, but still some sports are still going ahead. And so in Melbourne recently, so just in Melbourne, to put it on an international scale, in Melbourne, in fact, sorry, I shouldn't say Melbourne, in Australia, they've had their football grand final. And so they've Melbourne, where the Aussie Rules birthplace, because it used to be called the VFL, which was the Victorian Football League, and now it's the Australian Football League because it's growing. They housed all their football players, coaches, entourage, family, everybody in hotels for months up in Queensland. So they could play their football, everyone could get their football fix, and everything could still go ahead. And so now they've had their grand final just recently. So compare that to putting, you know, 17 orchestras in a football in a hotel room or hotel rooms for months on end with entourage and family. It just doesn't happen. Ballet, theatre, you know, it's a whole different yeah. concept. So that's where that comes. So the money hasn't been there for the arts, and it's been devastating. Theatres around the UK are actually going out of business and closing. They're closing, you know, and storytelling when it comes to the arts is so important, so important. Imagine if Stonehenge were to be shut down, pulled down and broken up into parts and given away, sold off. You just wouldn't, that would, you know, it would never happen. It just would never happen. And the reason why it couldn't happen is because it is part of the UK's history. I mean, it's, what, 5,000 BC or something? I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's around there somewhere. I mean, I've done the research and I've been there twice now, but I think possibly three times because I love Stonehenge. But it just, it could put that into perspective of the theatre's closing. So that's where stories are told, Stonehenge, you know, the stories of Stonehenge. There's all sorts of other places to go to. But also stories, history is passed down through theatre, museums, music, dance, art, paintings, drawings, spoken word, also all art forms. Our human story is passed on. And without that, let's go back to the cave drawings. That's where it started, as far as I'm aware of. I could be wrong. So those stories are told. So we have to keep those stories being told. And interestingly, even though we can't get paid for it, art is being, or culture rather, is being, is sort of going around and over and under COVID through the internet, through people still putting on plays and even some TV shows that are being aired on major networks. Are being done through, you know, video online on like Zoom, for instance, or other platforms. So it's interesting how it's still happening. We just aren't getting paid for it. But it's the drive within us to tell stories.
But that is a massive, yeah, well, there's a lot to unpack there, but there's a massive issue there about payment. And I think that firstly, your point is bang on the money. It's like, why? I suppose the typical argument that would come back would be sport is invested in more by private money than it is public. I'm not actually entirely sure that's completely accurate.
Well, there are a lot of sponsors when it comes to that. You take sponsorship rather than ownership. So no one, as far as I know, no one actually owns a particular Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah, but what the point is, what I dislike is, again, there's a number of things I dislike. One is there's a lack of solidarity to the whole kind of concept of people's employment in these sectors. Because, again, as they constantly remind you, especially in theatres, you're not just talking about actors who are employed. You're talking about caretakers. You're talking about everyone. Okay, so you've got that. But also there is, look, I absolutely fucking hate sport and I don't go to the theatre that often and I've never been to a ballet. But I appreciate these cultural forms for other people. Yeah. And I'm not going to say, no, actually, the only thing you should fund is live music in the cinema because they're the only things I go to. So I really dislike the kind of lack of, I've got to be a bit careful here. Look, we're in
middle.
Right.
Speak your mind.
I am, but I want to be specific because I don't want to trip over my own dick here. But the thing is that it happens a lot. but the look, I'm the first one to jump up here and say, you know, look, people have died. People are dying. There is reasons for this, and many of them are human folly and arrogant, stupid. These are the things you should be paying the most attention to. I agree. However, I also think, and we can, believe it or not, folks, we can hold more than one idea in our heads at any one time.
Right.
I do think that we also need to take arts and arts funding very, very seriously. Because believe me, folks, you don't want to live in a world where you don't have any art. You know, many a person, including absolute scum who I detest, like Winston Churchill, and everyone in this country likes to have a good wank over him a lot of the time. Now, even he would have said, of course we're keeping the theatres open. Why? Otherwise people won't have anything to do. Well, so even he kind of understood that. He understood that you needed something to look forward to. Shit, they made propaganda films. I mean, like the Laurence Olivier version of Henry V is very, very big on, patriotism of Britain and standing up for you kind of all this shit. So they knew, in a weird way, as much as I don't like the way that culture is abused by people like that, they understand its value in a way that I think far too many of the rest of us are kind of looking past. Going, we'll reopen the theatres down the line. No, we open them now. Never mind whether you or I go to them. I don't give a shit if I go there. Someone goes there. Someone gets something out of it, and some people get good employment out of it. Just make it happen.
Make it happen. There's a lot of people getting a lot of. I tell a little bit of a fib, but I didn't say. So there's one show. Now this is telling. There's one show that's on at the moment where they did actually isolate, where they put all the artists into lockdown, into hotels, and that was Strictly Come Dancing.
Oh well.
So they put the hotel, they've put the dancers, the guests, and they also did with the Bake Off as well, Great British Bake Off.
Well, again, like you say, a lot of money riding on it. I mean, there are two shows.
There is a lot of money riding on it, but again, that's also culture. I mean, it's a cultural thing.
The two shows
like Joe Lycett only doing his sewing bee. I mean, I never really heard of Joe Lycett until his other show that he had about, sort of outing disreputable organisations, which I just love him to bits for doing so. Mm. So with the sewing bee, I can't think Sewing Bee did the same thing, but I know that Great British Bake Off did, and Strictly Come Dancing have done the whole put everybody into lockdown, into a hotel, into isolation, and then obviously when people are voted off or whatever they do, they then leave and they don't come back. The others look, I've had a lot of thought about this. I mean, so there's a lovely couple, two guys who started off as friends in university, and they and I've watched, it's funny, I met them just by accident through theatre, and they were two young lads trying their hardest to break out into producing, and David Hutchinson and I can't, oh God, see, that's the other thing, I'm a terrible name dropper.
Terrible in as you drop a lot of names, or terrible you can't remember the name you're trying
can't
to
remember.
Drop?
I couldn't remember names if I fell over them.
No, I'm the same way.
That's why I probably don't get anywhere.
It's lovely to meet you, darling.
They tried really hard. They did. They worked really hard, and they strived, and they did all the right things. And, it's interesting. They've got to a point where they've met the right people, done their homework, done the hard yards, put in all the effort. David Hutchinson, it was interesting. They were Cellador Theatre, and now they're Cellador Worldwide. So they've got theatres all around the world. So I don't know if they own them, but I know that they are part of a theatre, a greater theatre network. And just before COVID, they told me they had Moulin Rouge up and running in New York in major theatres. They've got a bunch of theatres around the UK now. And it's just watching them just, one by one, I think they're just closing. And I worry for these lads and for everybody else.
Yeah.
But this is just a personal connection. That they're just going to lose everything they've fought for. Now, that's from a producer's point of view, but don't forget, you've got your costume makers, your makeup artists, your lighting designers, your lighting operators, even people who print programs and tickets, make costumes. Did I say costumers? Costumers, costume designers, you know. It's the person who sells the tickets in the box office right through to the stage door attendant. Mm. Everyone in that theatre. There's so many staff, people up in the gods who make sure that the curtain goes up and down and the sets move up and down and bits that move, you know, the orchestra, the lighting people, even the cleaners, everyone has lost their jobs. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people. It's not just the people you see on stage. I haven't even mentioned the actors. Sure, they've lost their jobs as well. But there are so many other people who are, that theatre wouldn't work without them. Yeah. It's awful. It's just COVID system. It's just awful. So I, the only thing I can think of, and that's where I was sort of going around the houses with my idea regarding British Bake Off and Strictly, is that if you were to put those staff who operate the theatre, you know, backstage, your stage managers, God, they are God when it comes to stage. They run the place, the stage managers. Without them, there wouldn't be a show. And even your writers, hello, put them in a hotel, house them somewhere, put a show on, record it and put it behind a paywall. So if we want to go and see a show, we can go and see a show. It'll just be on our TVs or, you know, our screens.
Yeah, we've seen a couple of them shows, actually. Yeah. A couple of operas and, yeah, but anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it works. I think that idea works. And it comes to concerts and we've had drive-in, you know, the whole drive-in concert. That's a great idea. So
it is. Yeah.
These things take money, and that's the thing. And obviously then there's legislation when it comes to government. So they've got to get their head around, and they're too busy just trying to keep people alive right now rather than keep people in jobs. And
I wish they were concerned with keeping people alive.
It's not perfect. I'm not going to say the government's getting it completely wrong, but then again, they're not getting it completely right. But, you know, there's, in my limited knowledge of stupidness, there's probably two versions of what to do in COVID land next time, and that is the East Asian version or the UK-USA version. And a lot of women who run countries now don't have COVID anymore, just saying. You know, Jacinta, and in New Zealand, and you know, Australia nearly followed the USA model of COVID, but then they stopped right at the end and decided to follow the Southeast Asian model with lot of lockdown, lot of, and this, and again, this is my original comment regarding testing. Mm. You know, I think from what I understand, Melbourne have gone into, they were doing a lot of testing of local areas. Everybody, you know, everyone got tested in that particular area and it worked. And now Melbourne are out of lockdown. And as of today, they've got no deaths, no cases for about 2 weeks or a week or something, which is remarkable. They're in lockdown but since March of this year. So they have had their protests, they've had a lot of stupidness, they've had a lot of people going boo-hoo. But you know what? When it comes to living and not living, we have to be a little bit harsh and a little bit selfless. And that's easy for me to say because, you know, I'm still working, I guess. But I'm not getting out of the scot-free. I mean, there's still a lot of things I can't do. And my, you know, being locked up at home all week, not fun.
No.
So I get it a lot of the time. You know, everyone's story is different, of course. And again, nothing's right. Nothing's perfect. No one's got this right. But I think some countries have got it right. And I think we need to just, you know, take a breath and just see what's working.
I agree.
This wasn't supposed to be about COVID, but we've gone into COVID land.
No, but it's a good point, and I'm happy to put those kind of points out there. I would only add to it before we move on that those countries include ones that we need to stop sneering at and looking down on or having an ideological block against them, because that's what this part of the world doesn't like. So Cuba and Vietnam and Venezuela and other countries have actually done extraordinarily well with fuck all money. whilst
Vietnam, everybody else was dying from COVID. Vietnam had no cases. This is earlier on in the year, until a woman from Italy decided to go visit Vietnam.
Yeah.
And that's where it all started. So they're like, why didn't you stay home? Just, you know.
And kids, if you want to, if you want a quick lesson in the dangers of colonialism and imperialism, there you go. That's what we call it.
Vietnam, my God, they've been invaded more times than I've had hot meals, I think. Yeah. Bloody hell.
But I think that's what, weird, that, because that kind of sounds, as a writer, that might be something that you might put into a metaphor that you might write into a drama. This one Italian visits Vietnam.
I've been invaded more times than I can think.
But you know, but you like you this know one. What, this, one least... this one Westerner visits Vietnam, and then they fucking disease the place. You know, it's just kind of like, you see what I'm getting at here, folks?
What I mean? Yeah. You know what, though? The Vietnamese are very good at making French bread, and there's a good reason for that. Only because they're invaded. They are. You go to a Vietnamese bakery if you can't find a French one. I'm telling you.
Mm. No, they're on my Vietnam's on my list.
Beautiful. Visits. Absolutely.
Yeah. So okay. So that's arts funding, or parts of it.
I was just going to say, with the arts, I was going to say something a bit sort of, you know, insular with myself regarding arts funding, and that I've never been successful in gaining arts funding. I can write a play and produce it. I just can't do an application for funding. I'm terrible.
Absolutely. They are hard. I know people who have done applications either to like make sure their bar stays open, and that took them like 3 weeks to fill out the form. Yeah, I mean, it's designed this way.
Yeah, look, there are people out there who can write them, and I think if you're going to do an arts funding application, you need to find someone who knows how to fill these things out, because it is bureaucracy just gone nuts. Because I read it and I think it's the same, exactly the same question 45 times. It really is. It's just there might be a comma in a different place. That's as much as I can, you know. So these people who are so clever, more clever than I am, much more intelligent than I am, and they can fill these forms out. And so if they charge, just put it in, you know, make it as part of your arts funding application. Just add the numbers on to what they want to charge.
It'd be the only growth industry in the arts sector right now is people charging.
Exactly. People who can write arts funding applications. Find them, hang on to them.
Yes, but make them dinner. Kidnap them. Lock them in your boat. Yeah. No, we do not advocate such things.
Actually, red wine and, you know, anyway, I'm not going to advocate.
Red wine and roofies. Okay, so.
I think I saw that play.
I think I dreamed it. Yeah. Just on, while we're in the similar terrain here, so art during the times of the pandemic. How have you lent on art and culture in these times to get you through?
How I lent on it?
Okay, that's a bit of a loaded question. Does it have a more prominent point? Do you look to it to kind of go, oh God, relieve me of the tension of whatever?
It's interesting. I'm a visual person, so a museum's good for me. An artwork is good for me. I can stand in front of a painting for about half an hour, and the party I'm with are like three doors down. You know, they've moved on.
Been there.
Because I'm discovering that little stick figure that, oh, there's someone in that corner. What are they doing in that corner? You know, there's someone's painted that little figure that everybody else doesn't look at, but I've discovered them and they're doing something really extraordinary. So for me, visual art is, and I would put that down to theatre. That's why I love theatre, because it is such a visual medium in the sense there's a lot of colour and movement, you know, and sound. And so I've had to revert to things like a lot of box sets, but I've also started doing a lot of reading as well. And I think I've got through three books so far in between everything else that I'm doing, you know. Three books for me would probably be like one book every 2 years. I mean, I don't do a lot of reading. I probably need to do more reading than what I'm doing, in the sense of pleasure, reading for pleasure, not reading for learning, because that's a whole different, you know, whole different thing. I've done a lot of reading for learning, but no, reading for pleasure has, and cookbooks and cooking. Actually, I've done a lot of cooking as well. So it's, there you go. Cooking's another culture. It is artistic. It's creative. on the creative spectrum. So I've had to find my own entertainment, which has been a struggle because I'm not great on Netflix. Some people go, oh, have you seen? Never heard of it. So I'll go and find it, and I'll go and watch it. Yeah, loved it, you know. But I'll turn to the terrible thing about these online TV streaming platforms is it all works on an algorithm on the thing you've watched last time. But I want to watch something different. Mm. Show me what's different. Can't find what's different because it's no. You've watched all these other dramas, comedies, and whatnot. So we're going to find more of the same. And I think, doing my head in. So yeah, so I've struggled a bit. I must admit, being locked up in your own home's not exactly easy. A lot of people will attest to. But I really do miss going to the theatre, and it's the whole going to part that I miss. It's the going out for a drink, going out for a meal, meeting up with people, and I bet all those shops and other bars and whatnot are also missing us as well.
Yeah,
because they're not getting that business.
I was speaking to during the non-lockdown. I don't know what you'd call it during the Valve release that we had for a few months. Oh. I managed to get to the cinema.
Whack-a-mole. Yes.
Yeah, but also I got to say, firstly, I think cinemas, certainly in London, the ones I've been to, have done a very, very good job of keeping people distant. And they've undersold their auditoriums by a substantial amount in order to be able to keep it clean. But I was at the Prince Charles Cinema, it was one of my favourites, and I was chatting with a fella outside there while we were waiting to go in, and he was talking about he's been furloughed this time, and they're a lot more relaxed about it this time because they've called it it's not a lockdown, it's an intermission, it's just going to last a month, and we hope.
Awesome. Yeah.
They were missed. Now, on one side of it, I'll be honest, on a purely personal, selfish level, I quite like being in London, especially in other places when there's no people around, because I'm not a big, I care very much for people's needs, but on a personal level, you know me, I don't have a lot of mates, so I'm not a big people person, and being able to walk around London when there's no bugger there is actually pretty enjoyable.
Really?
But I don't like because a lot of people, I'm not going to take a lot of joy out of that because too many people are suffering.
I get it where you're coming from. Yeah, it's if you take it from a really simplistic point of view, it's just that there's not a lot of people to bump into you.
Hmm. Yeah. But also it's like you walk through Soho and it's quiet and just like, oh, this ain't right.
Yeah, that's spooky. That's a bit spooky,
Again,
to know where the crowds are, it's like, oh, where'd they all go?
So I'm not entirely sure whether I'm building on whatever my original question was by saying this, but I thought I'd interject it.
We were moving on from arts funding. It's a difficult one because with my knowledge, and again, it's just my opinion. I could be wrong. I often am. With COVID, outdoors is safer than indoors.
I think that's accurate, yeah.
Airflow is better than no airflow, masks are a good thing. I think they are. I'd never leave home without it, And unfortunately with the theatres, it's three or four tiers of crowded people sitting in an airless room, all facing the same way. Maybe there's a positive there, I don't know, rather than facing each other. But then there is a thing of walking, you're always having to, I don't know about you, but for me, my theatre etiquette is if my seats are in the centre, I will make sure that I'm up those stairs and back into my seat before the bell goes. Mm. So I don't have to, excuse me, and walk on people's bags and feet as I get to my seat.
Yeah, I tend to sit on the edge.
If I'm on the edge, I'll stand I'll kind of be the last person in the door or stand on the side of the steps and just allow everybody to get to their seats first. So the point I'm making is, though, with COVID, you're passing people and you're passing a lot of people sometimes. And so then it's then you're sitting there and you're laughing and cheering and booing, and if you're at a panto. And then the heating is on, and in winter it can be warm and all that sort of stuff. So it's difficult to know what to do. But it's sad. It's sad that I miss. I can see it now. If anybody who works at a theatre, I just want to apologise in advance, because if I see the first usher I see, I think I'm going to hug. So I'm really sorry. Please don't call the police. Because I think I'll just be so happy just to be back as an audience member, just to see a show, you know. Or I might just jump on stage and just hug all the actors. And
I did feel that a little bit. Like I'm not normally one for, you know, either physical or metaphorical pats on the back or inspiring. No. I always find myself, I mean, the young people call it cringe. I feel like I probably invented that shit. But I had a chat with this fella outside the Prince Charles who was working there. And, he was quite chill about it, but he had his concerns and all the other stuff. And I fucking love that place, you know. And if they're listening, I'd love to do an interview with you. But they, we came out of like the fire exit. We've been to see Pan's Labyrinth, which is such a good film. I'd forgotten how beautiful it is. And anyway, so we're coming out the fire exit. And I come around the corner and he's out the front. And I kind of felt this compulsion to kind of say to him something meaningful or whatever. I couldn't quite manage it because I'm not that deep. But I just said to him, mate, I'll see you in a month. Guarantee it. And he went, yeah, cheers, mate, thanks. You know, it was just like, but I felt like I had to kind of say that because they still got their December program open. And actually, another, just to add to what you were saying about the sitting indoors experience, they've put in two medical air purifiers in both their auditoriums, which rotate the air. Yeah, which is a great move.
Interesting.
And yeah, and I don't want to. I just want people to know, like, we don't do advertising on this show. I am a free agent, but I genuinely love the Prince Charles Cinema. I love the Lexi too in Kensal Rise. That's another story. Yeah. But there's a lot of cinemas out there that I adore. I've got a lot of personal history with them. In my teenage years, mostly with my dad, I had some of the more enjoyable times of a very, very rough period of life was sitting in little flea pit cinemas watching films that no one else had ever heard of. And it was a wonderful experience. And the Prince Charles was high on that. But also their December program is open. And one, among other things, they show It's a Wonderful Life there all through December. And you have to see that film on the big screen. Because, again, kind of like United. Usually when people applaud at the end of the film, I think it's really cheesy. But the last time I saw that at the Prince Charles, I could completely understand. You know, it's such... People underestimate it's such a powerful film. It's wonderful. Because I'm not... It's kind of considered to be the first film that gave us a lot of that cheesy shit. And I think that's unfair. It's a really harsh film for most of it. And then it has an upbeat ending. Mm. But also... And it's got James Stewart. And I don't really like James Stewart as a person. I think he was very reactionary. He was a pretty horrible man. But he did make some fantastic films, particularly with Alfred Hitchcock and Anthony Mann, and with a couple of ones with Frank Capra. And one of them being It's a Wonderful Life. It's that communal experience of being. It's one of the few films that can pretty much reduce me to tears, although I always fight it like a real man, you know.
But look, I think it's one of those films that really touches the personal soul. I think it touches us as humans. I think it's a human story, and I think that's what it really is about. It's not about going at the war. It's not about coming together. I think it's just about the humanity of who we are. I think that's what makes it that's what gives that film that feeling.
And there was, I'll send you this actually. There's a brilliant video online by Renegade Cut on YouTube, which talked about something that I think a lot of us suspected for many years, but it was confirmed in, I think it was 2018, that the anti-communist brigade in America actually looked into that film. They didn't like it. because George Bailey builds all these houses, these affordable houses for the poor and all this kind of stuff, and he's constantly and he's constantly fighting with Mr. Potter, who's of course a greedy banker, in other words, a banker. So
yes, that's another word, a banker.
Yeah, and we always thought, this film's like it's seen as a bit kind of apple pie Americana, but it's not really. I mean, here's the proof. The proof's in the pudding. They were investigating it and demanding to look at the script and trying to find, And you're like, there probably is communist undertones in it because America's capitalist system fucks people's lives over. And It's a Wonderful Life is a film about this is what. Your life matters. This average, everyday person in the middle of nowhere, his life matters. Saying that, he's very unkind to Donna Reed in some scenes, and I've never really sat comfortable with me. I've never forgiven James Stewart for being unkind to Donna Reed because there's limits.
You've got to have you've got to be balanced with the film. You've got to be good and bad. Otherwise, it's just, another Christmas film.
It is. It is the ultimate Christmas film. Okay, let's launch into... What I'm feeling here is going to be part two, really. If I can keep you for about another half hour, we should be able to.
Of course you can.
Of course. Cheers, mate. I'll get two shows out of you. It's even better.
Do you know me? When you hang up, I'll still be sitting here talking to myself.
I'm the fucking same. I'll be like, why didn't I mention this?
Do your worst.
Okay. Well, I want to talk to you about. So you and I had a bit of a we'll let the listeners into this. We had a bit of a dry run, as it were, a bit of a chat about this the other day, and we were talking about culture in your life, our lives. So I suppose we're the real simple one, but we'll kind of get to like how you became a writer and why you became a writer. Both things I'm interested in. But firstly, when did culture come into your life? When did you start caring about whether it was music or art or films or what, or sport even?
Well, I think I have to blame my mother for sport. I never let her down for that. No, it was, strangely enough, I was 4 years old. My mother loves telling me this story. We're 4 years old. We went to go and see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs at Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne. Picture this, 1974, I think it was, summer or something like that. Anyway, and all the other kids were enjoying the show with Snow White. So it was a musical, right? So you got the orchestra and you've got Snow White and a big dress and all these little men come out from underneath her dress. And I couldn't have given a two hoots about the show and the story itself. I sat there for the full performance, both first act and second act, wanting to know, how did the curtains move? Why did the lights turn on and off? Where does the music come from? How did all those little men come out from underneath her dress? Mum was shh. And halfway, at intervals, she had to take me down to the orchestra because I was desperate to know where the music came from. And so from that, I don't think I really had a choice in what I was going to do for the rest of my life. But yeah, I was completely enamored just by the actual show itself and how it worked and the whole production values of everything. So from that, I remember that particular show, I don't really remember. I was four, so forgive me. But I do remember, though, going home that night it was the matinee, so afterwards, putting my teddy bears in front of the bedroom window and opening and closing the blinds and putting my own show on at the age of four. And now I've done the world's most embarrassing comment. That's what I was doing at the age of four. And that's when the culture in that sense came into my life. But you know what, though, in saying that, my father, before I was born, in fact, I'm going to say from when I was in the womb, my father played the piano accordion. My mum had a great quote, which I wish I could remember. It goes something like, your father took up the piano accordion, so I took up listening to radio on through headphones or something. Or crochet or running away from home. I don't know. She took up some other hobby that didn't involve her having to listen. Sorry, Dad. To my father's piano accordion. But I grew up in a house, though, always full of music. Either Dad was playing an instrument, which was basically the piano accordion, or he was listening to jazz. So for me, jazz was a huge, huge influence, with, you know, all the normal, you know, all the normal famous names. And so I've always had some sort of musical. So yeah, I've always had culture in the home. My aunt was an art teacher, and she took me to go and see the musical Annie in Melbourne. And again, I think I was under the age of 10. And all I can really remember from that was the boardwalk, you know, basically moving stage from left to right. There were two of them going into people standing in all sorts of poses, like reading newspapers, taking the dog for a walk, all that sort of stuff. And they're going in different directions across the stage in both, you know, both directions. It's been encouraged. My grandfather was a painter. He on my mum's side, I've got artwork of his now here in London. I've got 9 of his paintings. Funny story, I moved to Kyneton where my mum was born. I actually moved to the country town where I had a really strong affection for this country town when I moved out of Melbourne. And it was my grandfather's 100th birthday, had he been alive. And so my aunts decided to put on an art show, and they put an ad in the newspaper for anybody who had a painting to bring it to the town hall. There were hundreds.
Wow.
Hundreds of paintings. Stuff we didn't even know existed, you know, because he started painting when he was in his, you know, teens. So right.
Obviously got the skill pretty early on, and then just went with it. Yeah.
Well, his mother was a musician. In fact, because you're probably wondering how is this Australian getting to live in the UK? Well, I've got Irish citizenship because my grandfather was Southern Ireland, from the Ireland of Ireland, from Kilfinan, if anyone's listening. And his mother was a musician, and she travelled with Percy French, who was a English balladeer and painter. Anyway, so I could bore you senseless with my family history of culture, but it goes back to at least the 1800s as much as I know, because painting and music.
Well, that's interesting because of how embedded the cultural life seems to be in the story you're telling here. You know, it's like generations of, you know, I'd say as a comparison, there's only two of us here, so I'll use myself, I don't necessarily, yeah, kind of similar. I mean, my mum used to have a lot of music on when I was a kid. And me, my dad we've all watched films together, but he and I watched films very much as it was a mutual thing, especially in my teen years. But I don't necessarily remember it having that much. Oh, there is a painter in my family, actually.
Okay.
I can't remember all the details. You have to ask my mum next time you see her, but
I will.
But she knows all about it. He's got a few paintings of his at home too. He's good, actually. And there is a fella, deep cut here, actually, folks, if you're listening. I'm going to reveal. I don't normally reveal things about my personal life, but I'll go a bit wild here.
See, it's me. It's my influence.
There is a fella named Neville Luxury that, for those of you who know your post-punk, will know was the guitarist in Punishment of Luxury, who are the from Newcastle, I believe, based post-punk band. And he is a distant cousin of mine, or a couple of places removed cousin of mine. Wow. So that's my closest connection to that. Yeah, lovely bloke too. Really interesting guy. I should probably get him on this show, actually. But anyway, sorry. I'm rambling. Another idea. Another light bulb.
Another idea. Write it down.
Indeed. So when did you become a writer? How did you become a writer? When did you go? Was there like a click moment, as it were, where you kind of went, I want to do that. I'm going to become a writer and I'm going to write.
Oh, that's a long journey. But I won't do a Ronnie Corbett on you. I'll make it short. So my mum, I think it was a combination of me wanting to be an actor and getting me out of the house because, you know, children during summer holidays are just a pain in the ass. So she shoved me off to Saturday school to do drama classes. And then at the age of 10, I did a big what's called the gang show. I don't know whether they do the gang show here, but it's humongous, and like thousands of kids and adults, free time, all for fun, filling up a 2,000 seat theatre for a week or two.
Okay.
And putting on shows, songs, and you know, random stuff. And so I did that. And so acting was my thing. And so my heady heights of acting is like everybody else in Melbourne. We've done some stuff, who's an actor, not just everybody, some stuff on Neighbours and some short films and feature films and that sort of stuff and TV stuff and Home and Away. I never did Home and Away, just in case you're wondering. So if you're listening, Jason, I'm here. I'm the guy who's, you know, there's a scene of Jason and I, and I'm the one nodding and he's the one talking, and then someone tells me to bugger off so they can have a conversation. I was what they called an extra,
yes.
Not being paid. Yeah, that was me.
You were background artist.
Memorable moment, right? You know, that'll go in the highlights of the memoirs.
Well, the funny thing is, mate, I'm not going to pretend I remember it, but I probably saw that when I was a kid. No, but it's like you wouldn't watch like this. It's obviously soap opera, and imagine, oh, one day I'm going to know one of the people in the background of this.
Yeah,
or the guy sitting in the seat. Yeah. I was going to say, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah. Actually. So my claim to fame is we all sat. There was Jason, Kylie, Guy, Craig. I think that's it. There's a whole bunch of us. And it was a group scene. Like there was a concert they're putting on, and there was us, all the extras, sort of filling up all the empty spaces. And I remember sitting next. This is quite embarrassing, actually. I remember sitting next to Guy Pearce, going, "Oh God, you're cute."
Well, he is.
What's that?
He is.
He is. He is. Still is.
Great jawline.
But I was in high school. I was 16 at the time, 17, you know. So Kylie's gone on to do amazing stuff, as is everybody else. And I have gone on to do my own amazing stuff. I'm not going to put myself down. But you asked the question, at what point did I want to become a writer? So I got to, let's see, there was a couple of things that happened. I was supposed to go for a private screening with a woman by the name of Bunny Brook, and she worked for Crawford Productions. She's long dead now. And I got the letter saying, you know, come on this date at this time and that kind of thing. And I got to the front door and Bunny was like, never heard of you. What are you doing here? The receptionist, I couldn't get past the receptionist. So that kind of happened. So I don't know whether that was she was bored that day or whatever. So I never got anything out of that. And I don't know. I just, it there was a lot of near misses. I did a lot of stuff where it's like auditions and whatnot. I don't know. I just didn't have it. I wasn't clever enough. I didn't have the right look. I don't know. And I think I got to the age of 25 and I thought, you know what? I'm looking at all the other actors around me who are young and up and coming and more pretty and probably got more talent. And I thought, I don't think this is going to be me. And one day, I can't remember why, but there was an interview on TV, and there was an Australian actress by Ruth Cracknell, I think it was. She's also long gone now. She's left us. And she said, I think it was her that said, we need more writers. There's a lot of actors in this world, but we need more. We need more stories. And I just thought, okay, I'll give it a go. What could possibly go wrong? So I did, and that was it. That was the moment. I thought, well, I'll give it a go. Like, I have all this talent. So I've come through. So I've come through as a kid, mm-hmm. and all that sort of stuff. I came through what you guys call the amateur dramatics. So we've got the amateur theatre companies. And to put it in perspective, we have amateur theatre companies in Melbourne that will spend $100,000 on sets, just sets, not costumes. You know, there's lighting. So these companies have a big following. They will put on your Les Mis, and it will be just as good. Sorry, guys, but another argument coming. Just as good as your London production. It will be just as good. And from the mere production value side. And there's a lot of talent in Melbourne, and I don't know about anywhere else in Australia, but I know from personal experience in Melbourne there's a lot of great talent that will slip back into the amateur theatre world when they're not doing anything professional. Mm. And so that's the quality you've got in the amateur theatre world. So I've cut my teeth in amateur theatre. I've done everything from building sets, making costumes, doing backstage, selling tickets, the whole thing, right? The lighting, I've done lighting before. I've done some acting on stage as well. And so with all that knowledge from experience, you just can't give that away. You can't stop. But it's also what gets me out of bed in the morning. So I wasn't going to become the next Jason Donovan. I wasn't going to become the next, Guy Pearce. But then that was a good exercise as well. So then I wrote my first play. I produced my first play in the Melbourne Fringe Festival, won an award for, newcomer, best newcomer, that kind of thing. And I just thought, okay, this works. And the only reason why I believed it worked, because up until that point, I still didn't think this was going to work. And it wasn't until I saw the reaction of the audience. And I think that's what made me realize I can do this, is that throughout Act One and towards the end of Act One, the audience were laughing. And that was the intent. It was supposed to be funny, like I was wanting the audience, because they had unhappy scenes to come in Act Two. And by the end of Act Two, they were all crying, people were just crying. And I remember sitting there, because I had to find an excuse to sit in the room every night to do something. I just couldn't let it go. I didn't direct it, right? I had a great director, Justin Conkey, if you're listening. And so I sat there and I sat next to a guy who did the lighting. Now, this guy, without being too rude, if I saw him in a dark alleyway, I'd probably run the other way. He was a rough-looking fella, right? He was pretty scary. But he sat there crying, and on the third night, I looked at him and thought, you're crying. Oh, my God, if I can make you cry. I'm not saying he doesn't have any feelings, but it was just that experience of I can move people, and that's what I'm really getting at. I could see that I had something good here, so I'll just keep doing it, and so I've kept, and that was 1995 96